Groton's and Common Core standards. Gay student rights have been discussed, as well as whether it is necessary to disclose the salaries of charter school executives, among other things. Meanwhile, local districts have been making their own plans for the fall. CMS has been moving principals and teachers around while dealing with budgets, and over in Union County, the school board has finally agreed with the county on their budget. We're going to talk about all of this on today's Back to School edition of Charlotte Talks, and we brought in the city's leading education reporters to do so. Ann Doss Helms has been covering schools for 12 years at the Charlotte Observer, and though she is about to move on to a new beat, she joins us this morning. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
And Lisa Miller has been doing the same thing, not quite as long, but for WFAE News, and thank you for joining us again as well.
Thank you.
12 years. You pointed out just before we started that that means that kids who were in first grade when you started graduated in June.
Kindergarten. The kindergartners graduated, yeah.
So you're moving on to cover health care, out of the frying pan, into the fire.
One of my colleagues said I managed to find the only beat that's more complicated and controversial
that's
than education.
Right. Well, all right. Well, we'll have you back to talk about affordable care later on. Let's start today with Common Core standards. Now, these are the standards that were supposed to be, I guess, provide the same curricula and the same kind of tests in the states that were participating in Common Core nationwide so that you can compare apples to apples. If you got an A in English in Charlotte and you got an A in English in North Dakota, if they were both on Common Core, the A's were comparable. It was a Republican idea, I believe. And
I think it was a bipartisan idea, and it originated with the states, with the governors. It did happen during, I think, a Republican administration, but it was the governors, it was the state superintendents, it was the local superintendents.
But Republicans across the country are balking at this, and our legislature, which is Republican-controlled, has decided not to implement these. Is that the bottom line here?
Well, and there are many Republicans who are for this as well. But yes, a lot of the backlash you do hear coming from that side. I mean, there's backlash on the other side as well. But, I mean, what you hear a lot is, you know, we want our own state standards. We don't want these given to us. But, you know,
it wasn't the point of Common Core. I may be wrong about this, but wasn't the point of it to have the same standards across the country?
Exactly. It was, because you had these situations where, for instance, North Carolina had much higher proficiency levels on its tests than South Carolina had on its tests. But then when you took the NAEP, which is the one national test in reading and math, they would be very comparable. So that just told you that North Carolina's standards were low and were inflating our idea of how many kids were really mastering the material.
So if we already had our own standards and we were about to go to national standards and now we say, no, we don't want these imposed standards, we want our own standards, are we back to square one?
I don't think we're necessarily back to square one. I mean, there were two different bills going through the legislature or ideas on Common Core on this. And one was saying that you can't use the Common Core. You can't adopt it, whole sections of it. And the other one said, we're going to have a commission, and if they so choose, we can adopt parts of the Common Core. So it's hard to say right now at this point what those new standards will look like. The state school superintendent, who is in favor of Common Core, says that she thinks it'll probably end up to be tweaks. Of the Common Core. And now the argument has said, you know, against the Common Core, we still want high standards. We want to tweak it. We want it so there are our own North Carolina high standards.
So what's the point? What's behind this? Because this is not just happening here. This is happening in other states,
right,
particularly states controlled by Republican governors or Republican legislatures. What is behind this? What is this, political?
It seems to be. I mean,
But what is the political angle?
We could have
a
real discussion of the Common Core standards, but it would drive your listeners away. I mean, these are very dense, very academic standards, and this is not the discussion that's going on. There could be room to tweak it. It really is about.
But I mean, what is the political angle on this?
Well, the political angle seems to be that the Obama administration, Arne Duncan, the Secretary of Education, kind of got on board with the Common Core.
Therefore, it's got to be bad.
Right, and they put some federal money behind it, so the Race to the Top grants are pushing states to adopt the Common Core, even though that idea came from the states and the standards themselves came from the states. There's a sense that even though the states agreed to these tests and these tests are being designed by two consortiums actually, and that effort and money may or may not be wasted, that it's still, it's a federal test. It's the federal government telling us how to educate kids in North Carolina or Indiana or fill in the blank.
And there are some arguments that, you know, these, some of these standards are developmentally inappropriate. On the other side, you do have people looking at the new standards and seeing all the testing that has really expanded over the last few years and kind of conflating the two, saying, okay, all these standards have led to more testing, which the testing phenomenon is kind of its own thing as well. I mean, getting rid of the Common Core is not going to get rid of the high stakes tests.
What do you mean? What do you mean by developmentally inappropriate?
You know, for example, I've heard in kindergarten or first grade, counting to 100 was a difficult concept. I mean, there's a few standards where people have pulled these things out. I know, for example, what was in standards for eighth graders with the old system, maybe a few years younger one.
So you're saying that adopting the Common Core standards, at least in North Carolina, would have raised the standards?
That was certainly the intention. And again, you can argue,
what's wrong with that?
Did it raise them appropriately? Or, you know, there is a level at which very young children maybe are not capable of some level of abstraction.
Are these standards already in place in other states?
Yes.
Everybody's sort of in the process. Yeah. I mean, they are.
So what has been the outcome?
When
you look at the developmentally inappropriate standards that we're talking about, in states where this has been in place, what has been the outcome?
Well, it's been in place here for a couple years now. But the difficulty is that you raise standards and you have these new standards, and it happens all of a sudden. And it's a difficult thing because, on the one hand, you have teachers who have to be trained teaching differently to kind of encompass these standards. So it's a tough transition because it's expected to be a very quick one.
Mm-hmm. You don't have any states that are so far down the road that you can look at them and say it worked or it failed. What you have is a lot of them starting it, and invariably what happens when you introduce the new test based on the Common Core versus maybe your old test that had much lower bar to clear is you see the pass rates plunge. So it looks horrible that first year, and we had that last year. We saw really dismal pass rates at a lot of schools and in a lot of districts. So North Carolina, one response was to change the grading system, so we will definitely have higher pass rates this year.
Mm-hmm. So, Lisa, you mentioned this commission that's now going to get feedback from parents and teachers and curriculum specialists and make recommendations about what might replace the Common Core standards. And I believe, Ann, you called them, in a column you wrote, politically appointed commission.
They are, yep.
Why should a politically appointed commission be dealing with education? Why aren't these educators?
Some of them may be educators that are appointed, but I'm sure, you know, the state board is looking at this and saying, we're in charge of policy. We usually review our standards, and the state school superintendent says every 5 years we go through and we review our standards. But there are lots of instances where state lawmakers have made policy as well. Mm-hmm. So basically what this commission does is it hears from a bunch of people, it makes recommendations, and then the State Board of Education has the final say. But you can imagine there's a lot of pressure on the State Board of Education in that instance. Not pure recommendations necessarily.
Schools have to work well in advance. It's kind of like a locomotive. You can't stop on a dime, and you can't start on a dime, and you can't turn. You can't make sharp right or left turns when you're a school system. They decided not to adopt Common Core on the eve of its adoption within the school system. So what does that do to the school system?
There certainly is some uncertainty. I don't think on a day-to-day basis, I don't think teachers are going to go in, you know, on August 25th and say, oh, we have no idea what we're going to teach. I think they're still going to be teaching roughly toward the same standard. And there was always a misunderstanding that it was dictating our curriculum. What it did was say, these are the things we expect children to be able to learn at this grade level. But it didn't tell teachers how to teach it. So there's still some discretion for the state, for the classroom teacher, for the district to figure out what's going on in that classroom.
We're not 50th in education. We're 46th.
That's on teacher pay.
Teacher pay.
Okay, where are we in terms of academic performance?
The best measure is probably the National Assessment of Educational Progress, the NAEP, and we're better than average on that. And that's one of the points of discussion is that North Carolina gets relatively good results for relatively low spending, and whether that's a good thing or a bad thing, you know, the people who are cutting say, see, you know, you don't need to throw money at it. North Carolina's doing what it's doing without spending all this money. And then there are people that say, if you'd actually pay our teachers enough, you know, things could be a lot better.
So the reason I asked where we were academically is because the question, becomes, if we're already doing better than average, is the fear that adopting Common Core standards might lower our standards as opposed to raise our standards?
I don't think so.
Yeah.
Okay, so
are you saying the results would lower our results?
So in states where they're – I don't know who's first in academics in the country. I don't know what state that would be. But have they adopted Common Core standards? Or are they doing so well that they don't need to adopt Common Core standards?
Most states have adopted Common Core standards. I mean, now you see states
kind of
repeal.
So when you don't adopt Common Core standards, are you hiding something?
Well, there just won't be any common left in Common Core. I think it was 46 that had at some point said, yes, we're going to do this. When you start having large numbers of those drop out.
So what does higher education say about all of this? Because it would seem to me that they'd want to be able to compare apples to apples, too, when they're admitting young people to college.
Well, they will still have things like the ACT and the SAT tests that they rely on more, I think, than the state exams that we're talking about tend to be used more to measure the quality of schools, to maybe compare one school with another, one district with another. And the idea was to say, you know, basically we're looking for some consistency across time and across geography. Mm. How does North Carolina compare to other states, and how does North Carolina now compare with 5 years ago? We've lost that. We aren't having much consistency.
But in the story you did for us here at WFAE, Lisa, you said that despite the abandonment of Common Core, despite this decision, things aren't going to change much.
Well, a lot of people are saying they don't think it's going to be a huge change, the whole Common Core. A lot of educators, the state school superintendent, I believe I talked to in that, was saying this is probably going to be tweaks at this point and not redoing this whole system. So we'll see. We'll see what the recommendations are.
Alex on Facebook writes, GOP has veto-proof supermajorities in the State House and Senate and a Republican governor for the first time since Reconstruction. The party has been on a spree, and education is next. Next it's happening now.
Oh, yeah.
Hope teachers get a raise before the minimum wage catches up to them. Teacher pay. I deliberately did not start this discussion today with teacher pay because that's how we've started every discussion about education in the last year, because that's been the topic of conversation in Raleigh and around the country and around the state, particularly in school systems. But we will come back and we will talk about teacher pay and the sales tax to help teacher pay in a moment. We're here with Lisa Miller from WFAE News and Ann Doss Helms from the Charlotte Observer. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and the Charlotte Hounds. Charlotte's Major League Lacrosse team, fun for the whole family at historic Memorial Stadium, final home game of the 2014 season this Friday. Tickets and details at charlottehounds.com. We spend in this country huge amounts of money on health care for those who abuse alcohol and drugs. And a lot of the people with drug, alcohol, and behavioral problems also end up in our jails, costing us even more. It sends the figures actually through the roof. And that is why many experts believe we would spend much less if we focused on prevention. But the trouble is, a lot of folks don't know that preventive care exists, or where to find it, or how to pay for it. We're going to talk about that tomorrow at 9.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, congressional efforts to overhaul the troubled Department of Veterans Affairs, an update on plans to reduce wait times, boost accountability, and improve medical care for veterans.
Join the conversation on The Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 to noon after Charlotte Talks on 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on Listener Funded, 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking education 26 days before school starts or something like that with Ann Doss Helms, education reporter for the Charlotte Observer, and Lisa Miller, education reporter for us here at WFAE. The legislature has and the governor have been talking about teacher pay now for months. The governor and the Speaker of the House came up with their own teacher pay raise plan, much to the chagrin of the Senate, which had another plan, which actually raised teacher pay or proposed to raise teacher pay more than the governor and the Speaker of the House, if I'm not mistaken. But I asked the governor about that, and he said, this is what we can afford. That we can't afford the Senate.
The Senate plan would have gotten rid of a lot of teaching assistants to pay for.
So are we to assume that the governor meant by we can't afford that we can't afford to lose the teacher assistants or we can't afford to spend that kind of money?
I think it's that we can't afford to lose the teaching assistants is partly that explanation.
So where do we stand now? What is the outcome of this great debate that's been going on all summer and all spring in the legislature about teacher pay? Where are we on that issue?
Well, I haven't. Unless something has developed this morning, they haven't made a decision.
No. That's what I thought.
But they do seem to. I think there's going to be a raise. I think it's going to be a significant raise. We've all kind of gotten to where we're shorthanding and talking about 6% or 8%, but it's not going to be just an across-the-board, you know, adjustment. There's going to be. It's going to average out to a certain amount with some changes in the levels, the experience levels at which those raises come, probably some front loading to make sure that the really new teachers get a bigger raise because their salaries really are dismally low now.
Yeah.
Different ways of approaching career options and things for teachers.
Had there been no recession and had things continued on the way they had been going prior to the recession, would teachers be making substantially more today than they are now? I know they froze teacher pay. They froze state workers' pay for years.
The freezing of the salaries is a big thing. So it's the salary schedule is kind of complicated. But basically, it's based on experience. And every few years that you've been teaching, you'll get a jump.
Mm-hmm. It wasn't even every few years. It was every year. You were supposed to get a jump, yeah.
And then every few years, it's a more sizable jump. So that's been frozen. So right now, you have a fifth-year, sixth-year teacher making the same as a first-year teacher.
So we're playing catch-up for a lot of these people.
Definitely. And the people who don't like what we've done like to point out that most other states, at least last year when the recovery started, managed to give their teachers a raise in North Carolina. At least according to Heath Morrison, the superintendent is one of three states that didn't.
And I forgot which state it was, but somebody came here last week to Charlotte to hold a teacher fair to coax teachers out of Charlotte, Mecklenburg, and the state of North Carolina to come to Houston to teach because they pay more.
Now, that's not a totally unusual thing in recruiting for schools. CMS does it now. They'll go to states and they'll maybe not be the only person at the job fair, but they'll go to a job fair for teachers and they'll be pitching North Carolina. And one of the things that makes them decide where to go is looking at teacher pay at times. You know, they look a lot at where a lot of their teachers have come from in the past.
In some cities, it's been, you know, they're closing schools, enrollment's going down, they're laying off teachers. You're naturally going to go try to snag up some of those. But here, we're not really shrinking. We're just.
So since everybody does this, and we're 46th in teacher pay in the nation, what do we pitch when we go to these other cities?
Well, that's what I was asking the recruiting person last week when Houston came here, the CMS recruiting person. You know, what is the pitch now since most of the places you're pitching, teacher pay is probably higher? And she said, well, we pitch that we have a very diverse school district. If you want urban schools, you can get them here. If you want more suburban, rural schools, you can get that here. They say they pitch sort of the care and all that is what they say.
And we have nice weather.
They pitch the city a lot.
One of their little cards that they mailed out to teachers had, like, you know, Carowinds and NASCAR and all the things that, you know, you can do in Charlotte, good quality of life.
Yep, the location is a big one.
Yeah.
So getting back to the debate about teacher pay, there were plans that were put forward by the legislature that would have limited pay raises for teachers who went ahead and got higher degrees or advanced education in their area of expertise. They weren't going to pay for that anymore. And after you reached a certain number of years, you weren't going to get any more raises. That, I think, has all fallen by the wayside. That didn't make the cut. So what did make the cut? What do you think this will look like when they actually make a decision about this in this so-called short session, which continues to stretch on and on and on and on?
Which I heard there was a short session that stretched to October once. So hopefully
this could be it.
they sound like they're about to wrap up.
I think
up,
so.
Jim Morrill, our political reporter, pointed out. He says, I've been saying that for the last two or three weeks.
So where do you think is the governor, Speaker of the House plan the one that's likely to be adopted? Is it closer to what's going to be adopted than the Senate plan? Where do you think it'll come out?
Right.
A little prediction here.
It seems like the Senate's given up more of its big things. The thing where they would have to surrender tenure.
Seems to be a dead issue.
Yeah.
They've come down a little bit on their teacher pay. I mean, you hear the 6%, 7%, 8%.
The thing I always, this is a little bit like bargaining for a car. You know, that first thing you come in with may not be what you exactly expect to get.
Right.
And I always wonder, which big request is the distraction and which is the thing that they really want? And I do think there will be an increase in pay for teachers. Probably not really dramatically big change in how it's earned, although I do think there is an ongoing push that will continue to make it less about just how long you've been in the classroom or what degrees you've earned and more about what you can actually do.
Now, Mecklenburg County planned to put a sales tax for education referendum on the November ballot. They wanted to raise sales taxes in Mecklenburg by 0.25%, and 80% of the revenue generated would go toward CMS salaries. But the legislature, and I think it's being led by people from Mecklenburg County, by Bob Russo from Matthews. He's the co-chair of the committee that's put this forward. They don't want us to do that. They want to level the playing field, according to Senator Russo, so that all the counties across the state are charging the same amount of sales tax, although they are going to grandfather in Orange and Durham counties whose sales tax is already above the 2.5% they're going to allow Mecklenburg and the rest of the counties to have. So the playing field would, in fact, not be level. Once again, what is driving this? Why does the legislature care what Mecklenburg County residents pay in sales tax and where that money goes?
Well, you have somebody like Mary McRae, the chair of the school board, says it's punitive against Charlotte, Mecklenburg County, that we're a blue county that is led by Democrats. It's sort of a pushback. It may be exactly what Senator Russo says it is. It may be an attempt to rein in tax increases and give the urban counties a little less of an edge over the rural ones.
But now I believe it was in the paper this morning when they were writing about this, the appeals court in Richmond, Virginia, saying that Virginia's same-sex marriage amendment or law may not be constitutional, that people in North Carolina are saying, well, then our law will not be constitutional. And somebody said, I think it was a Republican, who said, well, that's just another example of the courts going against the will of the people. So if the legislature will not let the people have a say by having a referendum, aren't they going against the will of the people? They could have voted it down. People could have said, no, we don't want the sales tax for education. But now they won't have a chance to do that. So how do you explain these two? It's a dichotomy.
That would be a great question for Senator Russo.
Yeah, and the Senate still has to approve this plan, too. Or, I'm sorry, the House still has to approve this plan that would cap sales tax at 2.5%.
So where does that stand? They haven't made a decision on that either?
I don't believe they
and
have.
What does it look like? Does it look like, or do you follow that? Because you're not.
I haven't heard politics
and not education. I understand that.
Yeah, well, it's been so much. We were just talking about so much has been happening in education in Raleigh. So there's I've been listening to a lot of meetings there to figure out what's going on in the landscape, but I don't think too many House members have come out and said where they are on the sales tax.
Yeah, a lot of stuff happens. A lot of changes get slipped in. We were talking about this 55-page technical corrections bill. There are all sorts of amendments at the last minute. You know, there are more bills out there than you can count. I'm afraid we're going to do this year what we did last year, which is they'll bang the gavel and go home, and we'll spend the next few weeks trying to figure out what they actually did and what it means for schools.
Hmm. Charter schools have been discussed frequently in this session, this summer session of the legislature. One thing that was debated was whether or not the salaries of charter school administrators should be public. And it's kind of a sticky thing because these charter schools are run by corporations.
Not all of them.
Well, some of them.
Some of them.
Are run by corporations who then hire the administrators. But the money comes from the public schools.
Right.
The money that we pay in taxes to support the public schools then gets funneled out of the public schools to these charter schools. So it is, in essence, public money. So if public money is being used, why shouldn't these salaries be made public?
Well, there's a big divide even within the charter school movement right now, I think, with some people saying, yes, charter schools are public schools. Don't talk about public schools versus charter schools.
Yeah,
we
think,
are public
yeah,
schools.
People don't see charter schools as
right.
public. They see them as private schools. They're
yeah,
not. They're public schools.
They are public schools, and they are, by the charter that they sign, subject to the open meetings and public records law. But when we really started pressing that and asking them to actually provide the salaries, you know, it kind of became this big mess that started with the Department of Public Instruction misinterpreting the law and saying they're not subject to it. But interestingly, the administrators didn't come in until the very last minute. Kind of the argument was, we shouldn't subject these poor teachers to disclosure. You know, they're not really public figures. Why should
we know what public school teachers make?
We do, and that has not been the end of the world. But it became a big sort of the debate that you heard was, shouldn't we shield these teachers from disclosure? And then what actually came out was that teachers, in fact, will be subject to disclosure, but in these charter schools that employ an EMO, an educational management organization, a Charter Schools USA or a National Heritage Academies, it may in fact be the highly paid administrators who don't have to disclose. And I'm not sure that anybody would have really stood up and made that argument. The case they made was that it's like CMS contracting with, you know, a public impact to do opportunity culture or signing a contract with IBM to do technology. You know, I can't go get IBM salaries, so why should I be able to get Charter School USA salaries for the schools they operate?
And another thing, too, that happened, we were talking about the technical corrections bill, which was this 55-page thing that came out last week, was there was a change that said if you are part of the company that is operating the charter, that you have a place on the board. The nonprofit board that actually is in charge of the charter, which is an interesting change as well, because you'd have a vote, I believe, in some of the decisions going on with the management company.
Has the Observer or has WFAE done any investigation into what any successful investigation into what these administrators in charter schools are being paid, what the teachers are being paid, and if so, if we know those numbers in some cases, are they out of line or in line with what's happening at CMS, for instance?
I did that this spring after a lot of wrangling, got all the salaries for the 22 charter schools that are in our immediate area, and there weren't any big shocks. The teachers actually, there are fewer highly paid teachers in charter schools than there are in CMS, and I looked at some of the reasons for that.
So why hide it? Why want to hide it? What's the...
Well, it's interesting because one of the charter school directors who really fought it actually said, I knew all along we were going to have to provide it. I just didn't want to do it in the spring because I thought it would distract the staff. You know, if teacher A found out she was making more or less than teacher B, it would become a distraction.
Yeah.
So there always is that individual thing of whether you like having your – but that's not a legitimate legal defense. And the administrators, you could look at it, and you could say with any individual charter school, is that too much or too little for the amount of enrollment they have? But it was not wildly out of line. There were no – you know, and – I say that with a little bit of an asterisk because you hear in other states about contracts that provide some additional perks and benefits. I asked for all of that. Whether I got all of that, I'm not sure. We got a lot of new charters opening up. I think we want to keep watching that. You know, you want to know if somebody's getting a huge salary.
There was also a debate this summer about the rights of LGBT students in charter schools, and some feared that they would not be protected against discrimination. Where does that stand?
I think that stands with the bill that passed basically gives them the same protections under state law. And what the proponents said, there was a version that had passed the House that said they had all the protections that were provided under the U.S. Constitution or federal laws that apply to the states. So that apparently would have provided a specific protection for LGBT students.
Is there specific protection written into, for instance, the guidelines that CMS uses, or that the Union County or the Gaston County or the Cabarrus County schools use? In other words, is there really any difference between their approach toward this and what's written to guide that approach versus charter schools?
That's a good question. I am not 100% sure. I know when they had the anti-bullying policy anytime you spell out something about sexual orientation, LGBT, there are people that say you're creating special privileges for them. You know, I don't know. I think they did end up naming them as they can't be bullied, and I haven't.
So, yeah.
I think CMS did.
Yes, I feel fairly sure they did.
The idea about charter school salaries, the LGBT issue that came up in the legislature, this comes at a time of rapid charter school expansion around the state, and particularly here in Charlotte. What, there are 9 new charter schools that are going to be opening here in the fall. Are they ready to open?
Great question.
Yeah.
I'm not sure. We had one that applied for a delay, and then we had one that basically got about 6 weeks out and said, we can't do it. You know, and I'm not sure if they will do it next year, but they have some questions, I think, about something.
A lot of it has to do with enrollment. They need a certain amount of enrollment to make it worthwhile to open a school.
You mean when you open a charter school, people don't flood into it? The impression I got was that the need was so great, the demand was so high, because people hate CMS so much that if you open a charter school, people will flood in.
Well, and there are thousands on waiting lists, but part of what happens is if I'm not really thrilled with where my kid is, I may go apply for 2 or 3 charter schools and maybe a couple magnets.
Uh-huh.
So I'm actually, you know, my child is on 5 waiting lists. So when they actually start sorting out, maybe they don't have as many as they had thought.
And Lisa, you reported that that a couple of charter schools that were to have opened this year are not going to open this year, at least not in the fall. When was that decision made, and what will the impact on CMS be? Because they've got to take those kids.
I think that was just a couple months ago. It was fairly, it was fairly recent.
One of them was a few months ago, and one of them was like a couple weeks ago.
Okay, yeah.
And then in the spring, we had a Student First Charter School in West Charlotte closing its doors in April, I think, just before the end of the school year, and CMS had to absorb those kids. How often does this happen around the state, and what is the impact of that?
Charter schools close every so often. It's not – I think that was the first big closing in this area, though.
Mid-year closing is bad.
Yeah, exactly.
I think a summer decision not to open is much less traumatic for all concerned, although it's
not great.
And that's
usually how it happens when they close.
Or an end of the year. You know, your test scores came in, they're horrible. You know, you don't get to reopen.
I want to come back to that school, that Student First Charter School, because they got $1.6 million in state money to operate and $500,000 from CMS to serve 340 students. We're going to do the math and compare it to what it costs to do a CMS school. Coming right back, Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and the UNC Charlotte Graduate School, offering graduate certificates from healthcare to education and now accepting applications for fall enrollment. Details at gradcertificate.uncc.edu. Congressional efforts to overhaul the troubled Department of Veterans Affairs coming up on the Diane Rehm Show. An update on plans to reduce wait times, boost accountability, and improve overall medical care for veterans. That's coming up at 10 o'clock. And if you'd like to join our conversation about the state of education in the state of North Carolina and here in Charlotte and Union County and elsewhere, WFAE.org/Charlotte Talks, Facebook or Twitter, or Twistbook and Fitter would get you to us, I suppose, and we're coming right back.
It's not about how much. It's about supporting something you use, trust, and believe in. Members matter at WFAE. Your involvement is a critical part of public radio. Join the over 14,000 Carolinians who supported WFAE this year with a financial contribution at WFAE.org. Thanks for your support.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about education and all the stuff going on with education in advance of the opening of school. Lisa Miller is here, our education reporter at WFAE News, and Ann Doss Helms, education reporter for the past 12 years at the Charlotte Observer. This is her swan song on education until at least a year from now, because she's moving on to look into the Affordable Care Act and the impact of that on health care. This student first charter school in West Charlotte that closed its doors in April, as I said, took $1.6 million in state money and $500,000 from CMS to serve 340 students, about approximately. That's $6,000 per student, if I did the math right. How does that compare to what CMS spends per student?
I mean, it would probably be, my guess is probably be a little bit more than that, $7,000, $7,500.
So were they undercapitalized? Did they underestimate what it would cost to educate students? Is that why they went belly up?
Well, they had a lot of problems. And I know, Ann, you did a bunch of reporting on this. I mean, it seemed like it was just...
And the final audit is not in. And that's something that I think I or Andrew Dunn or somebody really needs to look at.
He's your replacement?
He's the replacement, okay. Yes. And he's coming from banking, so he should be good with those statements. They projected that they were going to have a larger number than they actually got, for starters, and they staffed up for that. And when their actual enrollment came in, they didn't staff down, which was one of their many problems, which is why all of this is a little, you know, it really requires a lot of monitoring to know what, and I think they get their first check based on their projections. But at a certain point, there's a, you know, a balancing out. So I think they probably got a much smaller check in the third quarter from the state.
It's called a reality check.
Reality check, yes. Yeah. So the $6,000 number that you cite, if that's correct, is actually kind of lower, I think, than the average with all sources combined. There's federal money, et cetera. Mm-hmm. It's very hard to say. People like to make blanket statements about, you know, charter schools are more cost effective or not. But there are a lot of variables.
So one of you wrote, because I didn't get this sentence out of thin air, one of you wrote that much of the school's finances went undocumented. Is that to say they will remain undocumented, or simply that we don't know what went wrong yet, but we will?
Well, and again, I have not seen all those documents. I want to see that final report. But the board was saying was that, yes, she didn't provide receipts, but we know what they were for, you know, that they were things like fixing the heating and air conditioning system for the building. Mm-hmm. You know, that's one of those things that I feel like, show me, you know.
Right.
You really want to know, was this money that was just spent badly for the right purposes, or that the paperwork was not done well, or was it really, you know, there were family members who were on the payroll. There was the issue of directors and assistant director who in the application said they'd be making a certain amount, and then when their actual contracts got signed, it was like $25,000 more. So,
and the reason we have more charter schools opening is that the legislature, if I'm not mistaken, and I don't fully understand this, they raised the cap. There was a cap on a number.
Yeah, they lifted the cap.
Okay.
It was 100 schools and were allowed under the cap. And so a few years ago, they decided to lift it so that any number of schools could open.
So of the schools that have opened and stayed open, how are they doing? Do they do academically better? Do students in those schools do academically better than the students in strictly public, traditional public schools? Or do we know?
I don't think we know yet, because this past
why not?
Year that's
charter
finished.
Schools, well, charter schools have been open for years. Why don't we know?
Okay, if you're talking about the existing ones.
Yeah, the existing ones, yes. The ones that are successfully open and have been open for a while.
It's getting that apples-to-apples comparison that's difficult, because as with district schools, the charter schools that are located in the suburbs that have very low poverty levels tend to have high proficiency. The ones that are located in the center city and are serving the kids of poverty tend to have lower scores, in some cases very low scores, although those are charter schools that they
lower
see.
Than the public school scores? Or
the
just
lowest,
lower than the
lowest,
suburban
lowest
scores?
Scores are at a couple of charter schools that serve, and they would say, you know, one of them is a dropout alternative high school, and one of them works with Elon Homes, so children who are coming from some very, very tough backgrounds. So, again, it's what's the comparison. If you look at Sugar Creek Charter School, which is very high poverty, mostly African American, the scores are not blow you off the top great, but they're better than a lot of the similar schools in CMS.
The reason I ask is why, if we can't make an apples-to-apples comparison and say, yep, you send your kid to a charter school, they're going to do better. why the rush toward diluting money or taking money away from traditional public schools and putting it in charter schools if there's no way to say, yep, it'll be a better experience for your child? Why do we do this?
Well, I think the big thing that people say is that it gives families choice. And it's very hard. I mean, charter schools, there's a lot of variation on, you know, as Anne was saying, their scores, their effectiveness. You may have a great charter school and, you know, a couple miles over, a charter school that's not doing very well. And it may not necessarily, you know, that could be the quality of education there, not just, you know, the students you're getting and the scores that are coming out of there compared to the schools that they would go to otherwise. So it's very hard. And when people are making a choice of where they want their student to go, if they want their student to go to a district school or a number of charter schools around them, I mean, if you're a parent, you really got to do your homework about these schools because there's a lot of variation.
And I think that's what the advocates of rapid expansion would say. Parents are the ultimate accountability, that you as a parent should have that option to look at charter school A and magnet school B and neighborhood school C and make that decision. And if it turns out to be the wrong decision, if charter school A isn't so great, then you can move. What you have is a situation, though, like Student First Academy, where those kids, I think, really lost a lot of a year. Mm-hmm. And these were not parents who didn't care. They were low-income parents whose kids, in a lot of cases, were not doing terribly well in public schools. They really wanted their kids to succeed. They got some really fantastic promises, and those promises weren't delivered.
And there's different ideas about how you set up charter schools, how states do it, how you authorize them, basically. And there's the idea that you set up a bunch of them, and if they're not good schools, parents won't send their kids there, and they'll just kind of die on the vine. But then you do have cases like Student First, and where you die mid-year, and it causes a lot of pain. But it's interesting in the charter school community that generally people want a lot of charter schools, but they want, you know, there's the idea that you want a very close monitoring of who gets a charter. And then you have the idea that it would be more of the competition system where it's a marketplace.
Let us move on. We only have 9 minutes left, so let's move on to some other things very quickly here. Schools are scheduled, I believe, to get state mandated A through F letter grades. We're going to grade the schools now. Why and what are those grades going to be based on?
They're going to be based on this year's test scores, which have not come out yet. Mm-hmm. And the majority of it, I believe, I'm not sure if they've completely resolved the formula, but from what I've heard, the majority of it will be the percentage of kids who pass, mm-hmm. which will be high in the suburban areas and low in the high poverty areas. And a percentage of it will be also based on progress. So a school that may have low proficiency will get some credit if their kids have made good gains.
So what happens if your school gets an A, a B, a C, or a D, or an F? What happens?
I'm not sure that's been spelled out. It's part of this whole push toward accountability that we should let people know how schools are doing, and that will create.
So it's like the thing in a restaurant. You walk in the restaurant, and it's the percentage grade of the health score.
Well, and that's the big fear is that you walk in and you see an F.
Yes. Do you want to eat there?
Yeah. Can you make that school better? You know, for a restaurant, it might close, and that's not the end of the world. But if you're that school that gets a D or an F, and you're trying to make it better, how do you get a teacher to come to a D or an F school?
Is this the first time we've done something like this? I mean, even if we didn't assign a letter grade to how a school was doing, didn't state know, didn't parents know,
No Child Left Behind was kind of based on this premise that we would have test score goals, and they were incredibly complicated. But, you know, if you were a high poverty school that received Title I money, and if you didn't meet them, you had to let kids transfer out, you had to provide tutoring. Eventually, it was going to force schools to close, and the idea was that by 2014, all kids would be proficient. And we kind of know how that turned out.
And you say this is still highly controversial, the whole idea. With whom is it highly controversial?
Well, certainly with educators. I think there's a sense that most people support some kind of accountability, and I think we've actually regressed statewide and in CMS in providing good, timely, reliable data, and there are a number of reasons for that. There was this new power school system. They keep changing the test. So it was actually harder last year than any time I have seen for me as somebody with a lot of time and energy to put into it to get good information about what's happening.
There seems
and meanwhile, they're going to give out something kind of oversimplified, you know, a letter grade.
There seems to be a lot of things in flux where they try something and in the middle of trying it, they change their mind. And this happens constantly. How can anybody keep up with it? And why is this happening? What are they trying to do that they can't see something through before they try something else?
Well, it's this challenge of trying to educate everybody. That's a tough nut to crack. And you're doing it in a political environment. So when a majority changes in the legislature or on the school board or when a superintendent changes, somebody comes in with a new idea. I mean, there's nobody – we're not having these perennial debates about how to fix polio because somebody actually figured it out and it works and boom, that's not a problem anymore. There's nobody who's figured out, you know – how to make all kids successful, or even how to give true equal opportunity where the zip code you're in or the school you're in, you know, there's always going to be some kids who won't cut it, but your odds are a lot steeper in some
schools. CMS is about to release a list of 14 chronically struggling schools that they are targeting now for intensive aid, and they call this the Beacon Initiative. How will this work?
Well, it's kind of Heath Morrison's venture into this perpetually challenging field. And what he's saying is, we're not going to give you a formula. That's what a lot of them do is, you know, we're going to do this at all of our schools, or we're going to give you five choices and boom, we're going to make it work. And the new buzzword is a deep needs assessment. They're going to go to each school, and that's what they're going to really do next year is look at what that school needs to change these patterns. And after that, they'll start doing it.
How's this different from Project Lift?
It will sort of incorporate Project Lift, some of the things they've learned so far. It's possible that some of the Project Lift schools will be Beacon schools, which means that, they, you know, moving forward, there will be these efforts. Yeah, it's kind of a never-ending layer cake.
It's amazingly Byzantine. CMS Superintendent Heath Morrison, who you just referenced, has said that it is clear which schools have consistently fallen short on mastery of academic skills and measures of student progress, and it is those schools which serve large numbers of students facing poverty and with student populations from unstable homes in dangerous neighborhoods. We know this. You've said this many times in this conversation. CMS is viewed as a national leader in their efforts to improve struggling schools. If we're a national leader and we still have problems, my God, what's the rest of the country like?
You know, there was some discussion of that. The Broad Foundation that pumped a lot of money into trying to fix this problem. And when I remember when CMS won the prize, they said, this is the 10th year. We really hoped we'd be giving this prize to school districts that had solved the problem. Instead, we're giving it to a district that's making good efforts.
But doesn't this say that it's not an education problem, that it is a societal problem? Because you talk about the topic of cultural competency and race having gone below the radar, but it hasn't gone away. Isn't this a societal problem?
Certainly, part of it is. But then if you're an educator...
Are we doing anything outside of education to address the societal aspect of this?
Well, when you look at the Project Lift schools, for example, that got that big infusion of money, you see them doing a lot of what are called wraparound services, trying to get parents involved, doing medical exams at schools, some of this sort of whole child approach. And... I mean, you hear a lot about parent involvement, CMS, other districts trying to do this. It's easier with Project Lift when you got a lot of money to help you get this through.
Yeah. Let's on a happier note, Lisa, you say that this year, in addition to everything we just talked about, CMS, they're starting career tech hubs and early colleges. Talk about that. What does that mean?
Sure. So there's a lot of different types of schools that are going to be opening up. I think that they're still kind of waiting everything for the legislature to go through and funding. But what an early college, they're looking at opening up a couple of these. It's a five-year high school that once you graduate from it, you basically have an associate's degree. Yeah, you can't. Well, yeah, you get a lot of college courses in there. And it's targeted at kids who may be going to college for the first time in their family. So we're looking at opening a couple of those. There's one in Union County right now, several throughout the state, and they've gotten really good results. And then you have a couple career tech hubs, North Mecklenburg, for one example. There's a health medical sciences at Hawthorne High School. So, I mean, Morrison has been really trying to get more variation with schools. He says we want to make sure that we give parents at least two good options when they're looking at traditional public schools here in CMS.
Meanwhile, in the 40 seconds we have remaining, Union County School Board has been trying for about a year to get more money from Union County for their schools. They went to mediation. A jury found the county owed the school district $91 million last year, and this year, evidently, they have come to some agreement. What is that agreement?
Well, they had to have the help of a state legislature, but there was a bill that said they got more money this year, but that the school board could not sue the county over funding temporarily.
Because it cost them $2 million to file the lawsuit, and that was the county suing the county, essentially.
Yeah.
Lisa Miller from WFAE News, our education reporter, and Doss Helms, education reporter for the Charlotte Observer for 12 years, now off to talk about affordable care. Good luck with that.
Thank you. Come back
to talk about that. And in August, we will have Dr. Heath Morrison, CMS superintendent, on to talk about the local aspect of everything we've talked about again this morning. Thank you all for the hour. I appreciate it.
Charlotte Talks with Mike Collins is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Our executive producer is Wendy Herkey. Our producers are Aaron Kiever and Tim Ross. Our associate producer is Alexia Girodi, and the engineer is Joby Sprinkle. For more information about archives, upcoming shows, and podcasts, or to continue the conversation online, visit our website at wfae.org/Charlotte Talks.
And support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Blumenthal Performing Arts, presenting the Bacon Brothers with special